Hello everyone and welcome to the Ecosystemic Futures podcast presented by NASA Convergent Aeronautics Solution Project in collaboration with Shoshin Works, a global firm helping organizations and nations navigate ecosystemic transformation. As our world is increasingly digital and interconnected, ecosystemic models are reshaping society, industry, the economy, and policy, and they are reframing how we build for resilient futures. Ecosystemic Futures investigates this expansive and hyper-connected paradigm and explores frameworks to help us achieve more beneficial futures. I'm your host today. I'm Marco Annunziata, co-founder of Annunziata and Desai Advisors. I'm an economics PhD, former chief economist and head of business innovation strategy at General Electric. Prior to GE, I worked in policy and in finance. My expertise lies at the intersection of global economic and financial trends with technology and innovation. My guest today is Dr. Aaron Santos. I'm really delighted to have him with us. Aaron is the president and co-founder of DNP123 Company, a nanotechnology startup whose mission is making nanotech affordable and easy. He's also a board member of NanoBio Designs, a genetic detection company that won the Innovative Small Business of the Year Award for 2022 in Indiana. Aaron earned a Bachelor of Science in Physics from MIT and a PhD in Physics from Boston University. So he's unlike me, he's a serious scientist. He has been an educator everywhere from a Boston inner city public school to private liberal arts colleges, and other roles have included data science leader and innovation lab leader. He's the author of How Many Licks, or How to Estimate Damn Near Anything, and Ballparking, Practical Math for Impractical Questions, both of which teach the art of estimation to a lay audience. Throughout his career, the one constant has been a strong need to promote science and skeptical thinking to the public. And I can't, on a personal note, I can't underscore enough how important this is. And Aaron is currently working on a book on nanotechnology, so I'm really looking forward to reading the book when it comes out. And meanwhile, Aaron, I'm delighted to have you here. Welcome to the podcast. And if there is anything else you want to add about yourself, go for it.
Yeah, Marco, I think you've got it all covered. And thank you for having me. It's a pleasure. I'm excited for the conversation today.
Outstanding. So why don't we start from the basics? Why don't we start by telling our audience, what is nanotechnology and how did it start?
Yeah, so nanotechnology is the science and technology associated with very tiny things. So we're talking about technologies that are about the size of molecules. So, you know, humans are anywhere from 1 to 2 meters tall. If you shrink yourself down a factor of 1,000 and then shrink yourself down a factor of 1,000 again, and then shrink yourself down a factor of 1,000 one more time, and that's the size scale that we're talking about. As far as how did nanotechnology get started, it's a little bit of a different debate depending on a different answer depending on who you ask. But in the, I think it was 1959, the great physicist Richard Feynman gave this excellent talk called There's Plenty of Room at the Bottom, where he talks about all of the great things that you could do if you could miniaturize technology to just keep making it smaller. Things like you could store the entire Library of Congress on the head of a pin by writing it in tiny, tiny lettering. The other area you could potentially say it started was with the writing of Engines of Creation by a gentleman named Eric Drexler. I have my copy right here for those who are listening without the video. Yeah, in that book, Drexler predicts the coming age of nanotechnology with this idea that if you could just simply rearrange different atoms and control how atoms move and how they connected, there would be almost no end to the type of technological power that you could have. So a lot of our societal problems are caused by atoms just kind of being in the wrong place. So healthy cells and cancer cells, pretty much the exact same atoms, but they're arranged slightly differently so that one causes major problems and the other is just how you live a normal, healthy life. If we're talking about climate change, just the little extra carbon atom in a bunch of oxygen molecules makes a big difference for how that absorbs and reflects energy from sunlight, which can have a major impact on global weather patterns and all of the big, big macroscopic meteorological phenomena that we see. So there's a lot of power in very tiny things.
So we're talking about a technology that can not just fit the Library of Congress onto the head of a pin, but also bring remarkable transformation in sectors that are of crucial importance to us, from medicine to climate and more. And I guess, Aaron, this is why it's not the first time that we get excited about nanotechnology, right? I think this is one of the points in your book, that we've had a previous wave of excitement about the technology. Tell us a little bit about that, how that wave of excitement started and what followed from it.
Yeah, so probably in the late 90s, I remember I was an undergraduate student starting in 97, and I remember there were two big things at the time. You could either go into computer science if you wanted to make a ton of money. The web was a big thing. Everybody was going off and creating their own e-commerce companies. So you could go into computer science if you wanted to make a lot of money, or you could go into nanotechnology if you wanted to change the world. And it turns out the folks who went into computer science ended up changing the world and making a lot of money. But the folks who did nanotechnology are still largely in the research phases of things. There was a huge amount of hype in the late 90s. NSF was predicting by the year 2015 that nanotechnology was going to be a $1 trillion industry. And what you saw happening is, by around the late aughts, so 2005, 2007, all of a sudden nanotechnology almost becomes a dirty word in the investment industry. And in fact, if you look at a Google Ngram of the word nanotechnology over time, it's just kind of going up and up and up. And then in 2007, it just drops right off. And I think a large part of that had to do with kind of overhyped expectations of what nanotechnology was going to be able to do for people, both not so much in terms of what it could do in principle, but more in terms of how fast that the technology was going to change things. People were being promised, like, oh, you're going to have these tiny robots that are swimming around in your bloodstream and curing your cancer cells. And we're now 25 years away from that. And we're still not that much closer than we were at the time.
No, that it's very important. It highlights something that I know you point out in your book, which is this juxtaposition of nanotechnology and the internet revolution. In a sense, the internet technology had it easier, right? Because in terms of the infrastructure and the resources you need and how quickly they have been democratized, it's a completely different ball game from nanotechnology, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And in some sense, imagine trying to start Facebook if you're Mark Zuckerberg, but all of a sudden you don't have, you monitors aren't developed yet. Keyboards aren't developed yet. You have to build all of this technology up, but you have this idea for this company that is going to have a huge impact on the world. That's kind of the state nanotechnology was in the late 90s and early 2000s, where people were just figuring out how to build the basic building blocks, how to manipulate DNA, how to manipulate proteins, how to manipulate all different sorts of metals, insulators, and semiconductors. And it was also incredibly expensive. You could create a website for a couple $100 at the time, whereas if you wanted to do anything substantial in nanotechnology, your initial investment was, all right, we need an electron microscope. That's going to be close to $100,000. We need a $1 million lab set up. We need equipment, renewables. So just the sheer amount of upfront cost in terms of not just money, but expertise and knowledge was way more than you could reasonably expect anybody to have and then come out with some amazing product, like a nano-sized robot, just in a few years. And there was a lot of background research that really had to be done first.
Exactly. And on this one, Aaron, there are actually two points I would like to delve deeper into with you. The first one is, you actually make an observation which I think is very important for our audience, which is while superficially the story seems to be that there was a big hype about nanotechnology in the 90s, then it failed to materialize and left us with nothing. In fact, this is not quite right, right? Nanotechnology hasn't truly completely failed. There are a lot of things we're enjoying today that are made possible by nanotechnology, even though we don't realize it. So perhaps it's worth clarifying it.
Yeah. So there's a strange thing where I think if you look at nanotechnology in movies, people people watch the Marvel movies and they see Iron Man has this suit that completely reconfigures itself. And they see that as being the only technology that comes out of nanotechnology. Nanotechnology has a lot of hidden successes and some not so hidden ones. The AI, artificial intelligence revolution that we're in right now, is powered by transistors and graphics cards and all stuff that is made at the nanometer scale. We just don't call that nanotechnology because it's not what we think of when we think of nanotech. Other things, clothing is a lot more stain resistant. There's in the medical field so many advances. The mRNA vaccine is a miracle of nanotechnology. There's a lot of technologies that are out there, and I suspect a lot of this will continue, is that if we do have the nanotech revolution, we're probably not going to call it the nanotech revolution. It's going to be some other technology that will give it a name for what its application is doing, even though fundamentally it's being powered by the science behind technologies that are at the molecular scale or smaller.
There's also another aspect that I find fascinating. I'll give you my take on it, and then I would like to hear what you think, which is on the economic value of these technologies. Because as we know, a lot of the internet companies, they started with great promise, and some of them have gone on to achieve stunning valuations to the point that if you look at the stock market today, almost the lion's share is accounted for by companies which are internet-based. Yeah. So looking at it that way, you would say there's been enormous value creation from internet technology and very little directly or indirectly from nanotechnology. Mm-hmm. However, it seems to me, because I've looked at these issues when I was at GE from the point of view of what we call the industrial internet, digital industrial technologies, and if you look at it from an economist's lens, what you see is that even as we've had this long period of excitement about digital technologies, mm-hmm. you look at productivity growth in the economy as a whole, mm-hmm. and for most of that period, it stagnated. So productivity growth was very high until about 2005, then it mm-hmm. decelerated and pretty much never took off again until recently. Mm-hmm. And so you look from that perspective, and the temptation is to say, well, the valuation of big internet companies today is mostly based on advertising revenue mm-hmm. and hopes for the future. The trick, though, is that it seems to me there's a lot of value that is created once these technologies start getting traction in the physical world. Mm-hmm. And I think we might be seeing with some digital industrial technologies now where for the last year, productivity growth in the US has accelerated. And I think part of it is the hard work companies have been doing to embody and adopt these digital technologies into their processes, which is hard. So I'm wondering if the same will be true for something like nanotechnology, which is what is initially a barrier, which is the higher cost of entry and developing because you're using physical things.
Yes.
Then becomes, however, once it gets traction, it becomes a positive because then you're really starting to have an impact on the world of physical things and physical product, which is going to be tremendously important in our economy. Does that sound plausible?
I think so. So I mean, I dabble, but I'm certainly not an expert in any sort of internet-based commerce or technology. But I think in the nanotechnology space, I think you will see an analogous trend. I mean, I go back to the Gartner hype cycle, which for something that's a very simple idea, I think it has a lot of at least explanatory power, if not predictive power. I mean, you see this a bit you're seeing it a lot now with AI, where AI was hugely hyped for many years, probably went through a few different hype cycles. And then we're just now getting to the point where it's good enough that you can start to see business applications really being driven by it. I suspect you will see something like that with nanotechnology. Whereas today's nanotechnology, if you look at something in the material space, I like to use the term, it's like you're adding salt to taste, where it's like, let's just sprinkle a little bit of nanotechnology, sprinkle some silver nanoparticles in to give this fabric some antimicrobial properties, or we'll sprinkle some carbon nanotubes in to make it tougher and more resilient. But those have their own markets, and they're, I would say, kind of supporting existing technologies, but you haven't really seen nanotechnology as an industry. Like, there's not, you don't go down to your nanotechnology shop and go shop for some nanotech. It, right now, it's really just there to support existing industries in small ways. I don't want to speculate too much, but I would guess that there's a non-zero probability that a similar thing to what happened with internet technologies happens with nanotech, where it almost becomes more of an industry to itself at a certain point.
Very interesting. And you mentioned earlier, you are more optimistic that now we might be on the cusp of nanotechnology accelerating its development. Do you want to tell us a bit more about why? What kind of barriers are being eliminated? What conditions are falling into place that will make the situation now different from what it was in the 90s?
Yeah. I don't think we're quite there yet, but I think one of the areas where we're in much better position. Well, part of it is we just understand the science of the molecular scale much better now. We know how to make particles of all different shapes and sizes. We know how to make building blocks of all different shapes and sizes and different unique and novel properties. Part of it is we have a lot more supporting technologies than we did 25 years ago. So I think of things like AlphaFold, where, all of a sudden you can start to predict, you can use simulations and artificial intelligence to predict what's going to happen in these complicated nanoparticle systems, proteins for in the case of AlphaFold. But I think you're going to start to see more technologies, more computing technologies that enable predictions of what will happen when we make nanomaterials with a certain shape or different properties, especially so when we start talking about how are those materials going to start acting if you ingest them as a medicine, so that we're more confident as looking at and exploring new technologies like that. Another area where I think we've had a lot of advancement is in the connected sensors and just data modeling space. So any sort of, I don't think this term is used as much anymore, but any sort of Internet of Things technology where you could imagine applying sensors to whatever your manufacturing device is, creating new nanomaterials. That's going to lower your cost and improve the quality. One of the big innovations I've seen comes out of a company called Emerald Cloud Lab, where when I was starting, again, if you wanted to do anything substantial, you needed $1 million of funding to just get your lab set up to be before you could begin any work. What Emerald Cloud Lab does is it's literally you design and run your experiment in the cloud. They have some combination of sensors and automated equipment, along with, if it's experiments that can't be automated, they have people that will go and run the experiment in some far off land. So you can imagine at some point in the future, some college kid in their dorm room is going to come up with a major cancer cure, and they're going to do it all from their laptop in a coffee shop, because they don't need the big lab. They can go and start running nanotechnology, chemistry, biology experiments just from their laptop, and have that work being done far off somewhere in the chemistry cloud, so to speak.
That's remarkable, because you're talking about actual physical experiments, right? These are not simulation. We're not talking about simulating in software what the experiment might yield, but actually carrying out the physical experiment.
Yeah. And that's one of the things that gets me really excited, because there's this whole issue with science papers and being able to reproduce results, and a whole bunch of studies talking about how the reproducibility crisis. Now that tends to be more in the social sciences rather than physical sciences, but to a certain extent, I mean, I've definitely tried to reproduce results from paper, and a lot of times it's been my own incompetence where it's like, wait, why is this not working? But once you have that standardized protocol where it's like, hey, you know, this person put their code that they ran to run this physical experiment, I can just copy that code and have the experiment run exactly the same way. That level of standardization is going to have a huge impact on our productivity, I think.
That is very true. It's actually, I hadn't thought about it in that context, but you're exactly right, especially in cases like physical sciences, where you can, in fact, reproduce the exact same conditions. But there's the problem with social sciences often is that because humans are involved on both sides of the experimenting, then reproducing exactly the same conditions is a lot harder.
Yeah. I don't know when we're going to get the cloud lab for social science experiments. That's probably a bit further off.
I think actually that from people I've talked to and things I've read, I think that is a field where it's probably going to happen in terms of simulations first. Mm-hmm. So there are people who are working on gamification of societies in the sense of much like in using the same technology as for video games.
Yeah.
But the idea of creating fictional societies with computerized agents, and then you run your simulations in that society. So you raise interest rates or increase and decrease taxes in that fictional society and see what happens, which I think it's, frankly, I think it will be a source of very dangerously misguided conclusions at the beginning. So I don't know if I welcome that trend or if it more right now it worries me more than excites me. But going back to nanotechnology, Aaron, you mentioned earlier nanobots. Yep. I think there's a simple question here, which will be, when are we getting these nanobots? But I think there is also a deeper question that is things at the nano level are different. So how do we look at it, and what is going to bring the greatest value?
Yeah. So a lot of times folks think let's just make the same technologies we have now, but make them smaller. So let's say you tried to shrink a car engine down. It turns out that the physics, when you scale something either down or up in size, I don't want to say that the physics changes so much as the relative importance of different terms in your physics equation changes. Mm-hmm. So for example, if you shrink your car engine down, you have a certain amount of gasoline in your vehicle. That's where you store your energy. All of a sudden, as you shrink your engine down, the heat loss through your combustion engine starts to become a lot more important.
Yeah.
Because the amount of energy you're storing scales as volume, which goes as length cubed, surface area goes as length squared. So surface areas become a lot more important at nanoscale. So when you look at a lot of the fictional technologies like nanometer sized robots, it's questionable whether or not such a thing could work at nanoscale, or at least work efficiently. One reason I think that, you know, a kind of a good indication that you're not going to have these teeny tiny robots that are super smart and you can program them in the same way that you might program a computer. One of the reasons I think that's probably a pipe dream is that biology doesn't work that way. And biology really is the best example of how we can exploit nanometer sized technologies. What biology does instead, so biology doesn't make a single smart machine. Biology makes many, many dumb proteins that all have different interactions with each other. And what you get out of that is a complex system. You can represent it as a network graph where each molecule kind of interacts with other molecules in different ways. It's this very complicated web of, you know, I tend to think of it kind of like a Rube Goldberg machine, but just with tiny molecules where, you know, if this molecule, this protein interacts with this other protein, which is going to cause DNA replication so that your cells can reproduce. It seems like that is a technology that is a paradigm that is better suited for solving problems at the nanoscale. It's also something that's incredibly difficult to visualize because you've got many, many interacting components as opposed to a nanobot. It's very easy for me to imagine a tiny robot that goes in and puts on little boxing gloves and starts punching my cancer cells. I think if I had to make a bet, nanotechnology is going to take off when we have a better understanding of complex systems and how emergent behavior arises mm-hmm. that gives rise to collective behavior of many molecules interacting.
Do you see a synergy here with I'm thinking about things like drone technology and other technologies which are significantly larger than at the nanoscale, of course, but they're also starting to think more in terms of systems, networks, emerging behavior. So there is some cross-fertilization here.
Yes. And I think a lot of the theory that's being done for macroscopic systems will be useful in the nanoscale. But yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think you're talking about systems where you have many unique individuals. I mean, in some sense, it's almost like the agent models that you were talking about with social systems simulations. I think those types of simulations in network theory is really the big math and data field of the second half of the 21st century.
It's very interesting and very much in line with the theme of our podcast series, which is on ecosystemic futures. And it's really thinking about at all levels, thinking about in terms of interconnections. It is fascinating because in the case of nanotechnology, as you've pointed out, it can be an issue of the greatest efficiency because at that level of scale, some of the bigger machines we think of are simply not suited to operate efficiently. And so the cooperation, the network of a system of much smaller particles might be a lot more efficient, but we're understanding more and more that the same is true at the macro level. So, and that sometimes we don't even realize it because we tend to focus so much on the power of a single machine or a single player that we lose sight of the complex interconnections that exist in systems. Mm-hmm. And certainly from an economic perspective, then you run into problems when a shock hits and all of a sudden your global supply chain disintegrates or there is something happening in the financial system that just goes haywire because you've lost track of how interconnected everything is.
Yeah, I mean, I went on a binge of watching a bunch of videos of Jay Ford and father of system dynamics, and just looking, it's very counter to our, I think, our very human ability to tell stories and be like, oh, this is this person or this company, this entity is the reason why such and such a thing happened. Whereas in truth, it's a lot of times it's hidden in much lower layers of, in these networks. And that's, it's very difficult for me to visualize like how we're going to solve network theory problems with any sort of predictability other than just by through trial and error. But it's good. It's going to be an interesting next 20 years, I think.
Indeed. Speaking of which, we've talked about some of the enabling conditions, especially on the technology side with the cloud laboratories you were mentioning. Yeah. But there are also issues that we will also require some changes in things like funding mechanisms, education, other societal institutions. What do you think are the most important transformations that would help this nanotechnology revolution to unfold?
Yeah. Funding mechanisms is an important one. And I think you're, I don't know that you're necessarily seeing a lot of real movement in this area, but I think you are getting some folks who are expressing frustration about it. And what I mean by that is there's sort of two extreme ends of research that is most commonly done. One of which is kind of the more academic research where you're looking to make some scientific discovery. Generally, the currency in the scientific world is how many papers you publish, how many citations do they get? So you're looking for really bleeding edge, first principle stuff if you want to make a real difference and make your name stand out in that space. On the other extreme, if you're trying to make a commercial product, investors are not looking for any sort of first principles research, not far from it. They want something that you can turn into a product that's going to be profitable within the next 12 to 24 months. But there's a sort of middle realm that I've heard a few people talking about recently where it's not quite fundamental research. You're not going to get a paper published in Nature and Science by saying, hey, I approved the efficiency of this chemical reaction by 2%. But that's also, it's kind of too, not fundamental enough to be very interesting to research scientists, but not adjacent enough to a commercial product that investors would be interested in it. So then the question is like, where does the commercial funding come for these in-between products that you really need to get a lot of progress toward making something into a commercial product to get it to that next stage? So I think that's one area is trying to figure out how do we fund those intermediate projects so that we can have bigger swings on creating the really exciting nanotech that you see in movies. The other area is, I think, both in education and communications. So if the COVID vaccine is any indication, I think if all of a sudden it's not just vaccines, but you're talking about nanotechnologies that are either extending human lifespan or being put into food that we eat or clothing that we wear or anything like that. I think there's high potential for people who misunderstand the technology to have an unnecessary amount of fear associated with it. Mm-hmm. None of this is to say that we should be sweeping legitimate risks under the rug, but we want to make sure that people are making policy decisions and decisions of what they're going to purchase and put in their homes and into their bodies. We want to make sure that's based on sound science. So I think having communication structures in place that gets reliable information to people out is going to be hugely important. Doing that through better science education is probably the most efficient way to do that I can think of.
Yeah, and I agree with you. And you're clearly steeped in this because you're not just a scientist and an entrepreneur, but you're an educator. You've been in education for a long time. So you see that. And it's actually something I've been worried about because at the macro level, you can see that a lot of the communication on scientific matters often gets distorted or politicized, whether it's for political agendas or for commercial reasons. And it tends to undermine public confidence in a situation where these technologies are complicated enough.
Yeah.
No matter how smart you are, it's hard to do the basic principles research and figure out for yourself what the truth is. So I think would you say that the solution goes through, number one, somehow raising the basic level of scientific understanding and scientific education in the populations through also better evangelization, so better and a larger number of works that can reach the broader population in accessible terms, and at the same time, probably a reframing or more honesty and transparency in the overall scientific communication. Would that be your recipe as well?
I think more honest transparency is essential. There's a little bit of, I mean, I watch a lot of physics YouTube videos, and there's a little bit of a tiff going on in physics between string theorists and people who think that string theorists haven't accomplished anything in the last 50 years. And I think conversations like that are, I'm not a string theorist, so part of it is I'm just sitting here eating my popcorn and enjoying the show. But I think having these kind of debates and having an honest discussion about, hey, like, are there areas of science where, hey, we maybe haven't made as much progress, are bad. We need to maybe pivot and start looking at areas that are start redirecting our research efforts to things that are cost effective and are likely to deliver the most value for our research dollar. That being said, that's part of the reason that I wanted to really write this nanotechnology book is that there is part of me that kind of feels like I was promised nanobots, and the most I got was these clothes that is my pants are stain resistant now. Like, where are my cancer cures? So I think to a certain extent, calling ourselves out when we haven't reached the expectations we thought we were supposed to, I think it's a healthy exercise, and I think it's only going to build more trust in, which we desperately need as we start looking at new technologies coming down the pipeline.
You had started to touch on the issue of risks, and science fiction has done a lot to help us get excited about the technology, but it also started to seed in our minds some of the concerns you were alluding to earlier. I remember in 2002 that Michael Crichton's book Prey came out, which is one that I found particularly interesting. But talk to us a bit about the risks, because you're talking about a technology that can go medicine, so putting stuff into our bodies to change the way our body functions.
Yep.
You talked about potential applications to geoengineering. So these are very, very sensitive systems we're going to be tampering around with. What are the risks, and how do we best protect ourselves?
Yeah, I would break risks into two categories. One of which is sort of fictional. This is like not going to happen in our universe, our size type of risks. And then there's the legitimate, hey, this could mess up the environment or people could get sick from it risks. You mentioned the Michael Crichton novel Prey, and there's a research paper that came out in about nanotechnology communication about 20 years ago. But it was looking at the different articles, speaking of communication, different articles published on nanotechnology. And it was some weird statistic, like more of those articles cited Michael Crichton's Prey than cited actual science research papers. So for those who don't know, the Michael Crichton novel has these swarms of nanobots. I don't think they use this term in the book, but one of the common terms is this gray goo. Like nanotechnology is going to start eating atoms and creating more of themselves, and it's going to take over the world. There's a lot of scientific reasons to believe that that's just not going to happen. And it's great science fiction, but it's not really good science fact. Where I think the bigger risks lie are in things like if we start adding large amounts of material, if we start producing large amounts of nanoparticles. Right now, silver nanoparticles are in large amounts of materials because they have antimicrobial properties. Silver nanoparticles probably aren't going to kill you for the simple reason that there's such a small amount of them that there's simply, and they're expensive. So we simply can't afford to poison people with silver nanoparticles. Right? It's,
to an economist, that is particularly reassuring.
It's also, silver nanoparticles have the toxicity of table salt, which if you get enough of that, sure, that'll kill you, but we're not banning table salt. Where I get a little bit more nervous is on the side of some of the DIY biology. So you can go online and buy a CRISPR kit right now and start changing the genetics of your houseplants if you really want to. There was a story, this is probably about 10 years ago at this point, where there was a biohacker who had lactose intolerance and evidently really wanted to eat pizza again. So he got a CRISPR kit, somehow injected himself with the lactase gene, and then shows a video of himself later eating pizza. But I think Wired had a headline about it that was something like the age of garage biology is here. So that kind of technology worries me a little bit more. Not so much on the injecting yourself with different things, but more along the lines of if you do have bad actors that are trying to, I don't want to get too dark here, but if we live in a country that has, a sadly high amount of school shooters. If you have someone who's deranged that wants to do damage, now imagine that they're doing that with a CRISPR kit and with some sort of virus, as opposed to a gun that's as horrible as that sounds. Those episodes are a pale in comparison to the damage that you could inflict with some sort of genetically engineered virus. Fortunately, I think we're far away enough from that technology that we've got some time in place to come up with rules and regulations that restrict that level of damage. But that's of all the things with nanotechnology, I would say the DIY biology stuff concerns me the most.
I tend to agree. Aaron, before we close, I wanted to switch the lens to the even more macro level. So if we project the world, say, 20, 30 years from now, mm-hmm. assume that this nanotechnology revolution has made tremendous strides, mm-hmm. we leave aside the more, the darker concerns, and so we assume that regulations...
We do everything right.
We do everything right.
Okay.
Still, what are some of the potential implications? I mean, you mentioned potential implications that range from the philosophical to the economic. Let's start on the philosophical side. What are some of the societal and philosophical implications that would arise from this?
Yeah. So I feel like for this portion of the conversation, like I'm going to take off my science hat and pretend we're just two guys drinking in a bar at night and just... Because there's questionable amount of how realistic any of this is. But one of the, there are a lot of folks who are very excited about anti-aging technologies. So there's I think it's in clinical trial right now. I think it's called the TAME study, looking at metformin and can that have any sort of longevity impact? If you listen to somebody like a Ray Kurzweil, he's convinced that we're going to reach longevity escape velocity by 2040. I'm very skeptical that that's going to be the case. But if it is, that brings up lots of philosophical questions. One, is it even possible for a human body to live forever? Mm-hmm. Two, like, what does that do? Like, if retirement age is 65 and then all of a sudden folks are living, even if it's not forever, let's say folks are living to 110, what does that do to society? How do we have to restructure for that? On the economic side, Drexler in his book Engines of Creation it's almost, I think it's almost like a throwaway line, but he talks about if you do have nanotechnology that, say you have a personal nanofactory where you've got something that's the size of a desk and you put some old leaves or scraps in it and it can rearrange the atoms inside to be whatever you want. So mm-hmm. could be a turkey dinner, could be a new computer, what have you. Again, we're in the realm of science fiction right now. Very skeptical we're going to get there, certainly not within my lifetime. But if you do have a technology like that, like how does that restructure society? I mean, does it, we have a government that charges taxes to build roads. Well, if you have a machine that can just reconstruct roads out of the atoms in its vicinity, do you still have a tax system that way? What does that do to capitalism? AI has a lot of these sorts of questions as well, where if AI is often seen as a source of labor, but you know, if all of a sudden, so we think people aren't going to have jobs, but if I have an AI where I'm like, hey, I want you to make me the new latest Marvel movie, make me a new Captain America movie. I want to see what it'll look like. If AI can do that at some point, what does that do? How does that affect not just workers, but also the companies that employ them? On the nanotechnology side, it's like AI, but maybe even a little bit more so, because you're not just creating digital goods, you're also creating physical, tangible goods as well. So the idea of being able to, at some point in a distant future, have these replicators really forces you to, it will really force you to rethink what does it mean to be living in a society when we have that level of control over matter.
It's very interesting, because what you're describing is potentially a society which reaches a level of unlimited abundance.
Yes.
And all our social systems, and even I think our psychological wiring as humans, mm-hmm. has been shaped by a world of scarcity.
Yes.
So the economic system is geared to optimizing the use of limited resources to achieve whatever means we have. And also the way we think of ourselves within society is very often tied to what we can do to contribute to society's betterment. So if you take all that away, and there's no need for anybody to do anything because we have wonderful technologies and machines that can produce anything we might want to do, it's going to be fantastic in terms of eliminating poverty, disease, etc. But you have to wonder, what are the implications for human psychology, and how do you find purpose in life, and how do you order society? How do you structure it?
Yeah, I mean, even as a researcher, when I see AI doing a lot of the stuff that I used to do, I'm like, there is a bit of, I almost feel like there's going to be a point where I have to reevaluate what's my purpose here, if it can do it a lot better than I can.
And it also, here, we're at the risk of getting too philosophical, so we'll cut it short soon and leave the bar because it's getting late. But it also leads you to ask fairly profound questions as to what does it mean to be human? What is the meaning, the true meaning of intelligence, and what is the true meaning of human consciousness? So it's one reason why I find these scientific advances so fascinating is I'm not too worried or excited about a future of abundance or mass unemployment, because like you, I think we are very far away from it. Mm. But what I love is the fact that you're forced to ask very hard questions on, do we understand what we are as human beings?
Yeah.
What is free will? What is consciousness? What is intelligence really? Mm. And maybe we understand a little bit more. We realize how far we can go in understanding it and the points beyond which we can never reach. But it's a very fascinating intellectual journey in itself.
Yeah, I mean, I think in at least my early stages of writing the book, questions that I just haven't thought about since I was a teenager, what is the free will and consciousness questions? I think nanotechnology, being able to look at what's going on inside your own body, not as a single entity, but as this biological soup of like little dumb, tiny Rube Goldberg machines that are just interacting with each other. And yet out of that springs consciousness and perhaps some level of free will. Like, mm-hmm. the world is a weird and fascinating place, and I do not understand most of it.
That makes at least the two of us. Aaron, you used the metaphor of two guys talking in a bar for this last part of our conversation, so I'm going to issue the last call.
Okay.
As we come to the end of our conversation, we've covered a lot of ground. It's been a fascinating discussion. I loved it. Is there anything that we did not cover but should have, or otherwise a final message you would really like the audience to take away from our conversation?
I think we covered a good amount of ground, so I won't add anything there. But as a final message, just be, you know, with anything nanotechnology or otherwise, be skeptical. And if any of you are interested in learning more about this, I am now teaching physics over at Simpson College. So we're certainly looking for good, talented students that have these kind of questions. So feel free to shoot me an email, and I'm happy to respond that way.
Excellent. And your email is?
firstname.lastname@simpson.edu, aaron.santos@simpson.edu.
Perfect. Aaron, Dr. Santos, this has been such a pleasure, such a great conversation. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Yep. Thanks, Marco. It was a pleasure.
And thanks, everyone, for joining us today. Please do check out the season's new episodes as they continue to come out and explore the convergence of innovation, technology, and refactor business models, and how this convergence is reshaping industry and what all this means for our ecosystemic futures. If you enjoyed the podcast, follow us, subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or whatever your favorite place for podcasts is. And you can always learn more or apply to be a guest speaker at shoshinworks.com. Thank you, everyone.